Hello, and welcome back to the Ace Pod, which is evidently named itself. This is episode 1.1. Glad you're back. Today we have perhaps the sexiest MGO podcast episode ever of any variety. Hopefully, this isn't the end of everything for this podcast. No way in hell I'm going outside today, even more than usual. But that's okay, because Michigan is coming off a pretty great win over Ohio State to move to 20-1. We got ourselves a little bit of a rivalry brouhaha last night involving Caleb Wesson and Xavier Simpson and Jordan Poole, and a lot of salt from the Ohio State end after Michigan controlled most of the game, really the whole thing. And the big story, obviously, is that we got to see Xavier Simpson, a guy who does not normally stuff the stat sheet, put up a triple-double, 11 points, 10 boards, 12 assists, no turnovers, two steals, one thunderous chase-down block of Caleb Wesson, who really did have a rough evening. A rough and embarrassing evening for Ohio State. But to circle back to Simpson, who was just masterful in his control of the offense, and also in his control of the defense, this is only the fifth time he's picked up a KenPom MVP award for a single game. Again, he is not a stat sheet stuffer. But one of those KenPom MVP awards came against Ohio State in the home game last year, so this isn't totally unfamiliar territory for him. But it was just awesome to see the way he played yesterday, the way he is clearly the emotional leader of this team. I mean, you saw it as the team rallied around him after, I guess, Wesson set a bit of a hard screen on him to kind of kick off that confrontation towards the end of the game. But you know, this team's got Simpson's back. Jordan Poole certainly does. John Teske certainly does. It was a lot of fun to see those guys jump in there. That's what a rivalry game is about. It's fun when you knock the other team off their game to the level that Michigan did. Ohio State, in the midst of getting frustrated into their worst offensive performance of the season, starts to kind of lose their composure towards the end. You got a lot of Ohio State fans mad online. It's good times, man. It's really good times right now. I mean, this was Ohio State only scored 0.79 points per possession. They go 5-for-21 from beyond the arc. They don't do a whole lot better inside of it. Caleb Wesson starts off the game hitting a couple shots, and it looks like he might be a really major factor. He ends up going 3-for-10 from two, scores 12 points, but needs 12 shots to get there. Fouls out of the game. His foul progression goes silly foul off an offensive rebound attempt, silly foul off an offensive rebound attempt, another silly foul off an offensive rebound attempt, and a technical foul before he fouled out during the brouhaha. He just got totally taken out of his game by John Teske. This is one of those games where Teske actually does not make the impact that he has recently in the box score. He only comes away with one block, only scores 4 points, makes just one shot from the field, even only pulls down 5 boards. But that really undersells the job he did in just totally throwing Wesson off his game, making it really difficult for him to get clean looks at the basket. He had a little bit of an adjustment period where he was letting Wesson get too deep in the post early in the game, setting up, letting him go to his preferred hand. He did a much better job later in the game of forcing him to his offhand, standing up straight, not letting him get early established position in the post. And Ohio State doesn't have a lot of options beyond him. The main one is CJ Jackson, and if your main option beyond your number one guy is a point guard and you're going against Michigan and your number one option isn't doing very well, that's trouble, especially when Xavier Simpson is having the game of his life. So, I mean, the only slight downside for Michigan from this game was that it was another one where Jordan Poole could not quite find his shot, although he did hit a few big baskets in this game. He goes 3 for 10 from beyond the arc, 2 for 4 inside of it, but doesn't dish out any assists, has 3 turnovers. He's been playing a little fast and loose with the ball. It seems more careless than anything else, stuff where if Michigan had a little bit more depth, you'd expect John Beilein to be giving him a quick hook and a quick talking to before sending him back in. But this was a game where Michigan essentially goes 6 deep. Eli Brooks only plays 5 minutes, even though Michigan controls this game for the most part. Brandon Johns only goes 3, and some of that is in garbage time. The bench mob gets 1 minute apiece, but, you know, Poole's logging 38 minutes in this one. Simpson 36, Iggy 35. This is a team that still needs to establish some depth, but at the same time, they're playing so well that you're really just hoping for maybe one more guy to emerge. And meanwhile, I cannot talk enough about how great Simpson's performance was. I've got a very fun stat from the great Bart Torvik. If you look at the best players in the country at hook shots this year, you know, it's a shot that not a lot of people take. You know, there are only a handful of people who have taken more than about 15. And when you sort through that group, Xavier Simpson is 12th in hook shot percent at 55%. He is 12 for 22 on hook shots this year. And as you'd probably guess from that list, he is the only guy shorter than 6'7", and he is listed at an extremely generous 6 feet. I have stood eye to eye with Xavier Simpson. And let's just say that I'd be listed at 6 feet as well, and I'm a 5'10". But you can even dig into this stat more and look at the players in the country who are shorter than 6'5", and the most hook shots made by them. This is again from Bart Torvik. Xavier Simpson, again, 12 for 22. No other player who is 6'5 or shorter has made more than 2 hook shots this season. And you've got to keep in mind, too, that with Xavier Simpson, these are running sky hooks, not, you know, baby hooks from the post. You know, the top hook shot artist in the country is Bruno Fernando, who's a burly 6'10 forward/center for Maryland with some NBA prospects. And this list is littered with guys like him. The most prolific hook shot shooter in the country is Ethan Happ. Those are the guys you expect. Some guy who, you know, puts a shoulder into a post player and just kind of flips it over his head with his hand at rim level. Xavier Simpson decidedly does not do that and is still this productive. Michigan notches a fun win, 16-point win over Ohio State in large part, you know, for the most part, because of Simpson's great work. This was a solid all-around team game, but Simpson really orchestrated the whole thing. He finishes with 12 of Michigan's 15 assists. He is the only player to hit more than 2 shots inside the arc. He has 4, a couple of which are those absurd hook shots. He keeps C.J. Jackson to 11 points, and just, I mean, if you watched the end of the game, you saw how that team rallied around him, how the crowd rose up around him. Especially, it was lovely to get that moment at the end of the game, as where Beilein gave him a solo walk to the bench as he took him out for David DeJulius before sending in the rest of the bench mob so he could get an ovation from the crowd, a very deserved ovation from the crowd. One last thing on this game quickly before move on to something a little new is this was a nice bounce back for Iggy Brazdeikis, who seems very much back on track after his donut against Wisconsin a few games ago. Since then, he has worked his way to a not so efficient, but needed 18 points against Minnesota, and then he's had two efficient games since then, dropping 20 against Indiana, winning KenPom MVP honors in that game, and then 14 points in this one, 2-for-4 inside the arc, 2-for-3 beyond it, nice corner three, and towards the end of the game to really kind of help keep it blown open, I guess. So he's still not dishing it out too much. He still has a couple moments a game where you see him kind of taking into traffic and wish he'd looked to dish a little bit more. He did have three turnovers in this one, but he's been excellent on defense, comes up with two steals in this game, is generally just solid in his positioning. And, you know, the Wisconsin game very, very much feels like an outlier at this point. And now, inspired by a Twitter thread last night, here is quite possibly the most ridiculous thing I've ever devoted to audio, which, if you're familiar with me, is really saying something. Hello. How are you tonight? Would you like to hear some fancy stats? I thought you might. You seem a little dirty like that. Got that KenPom subscription and that Torvik bookmark. Trying to get that pirated Synergy login. Oh yeah. I know what you're about. And I've got what you need. Welcome to Fancy Stats After Dark. Did you know that Xavier Simpson has a 30% assist rate? And only a 10% turnover rate in Big Ten games this season. I thought you might like that. But I could do you one better. Oh, I don't even know if I want to hit you with one this hot this quickly. I'm going to keep scrolling for a moment. At 5.4%, Michigan has the lowest opponent steal rate of any team in the country by nearly a full percent. How does that hit you? Oh, we got some love for the big guys, too. Always got love for the big guys. Thank you to Bart Torvik's Player Finder. John Teske is one of just 3 7-footers in the entire country to make more than 4 3-pointers on the season. He is 12 for 35. And in conference games, he is hitting 46% of his triples. Let that wash over you. Light some candles, because we've got a very special fancy stat from our very own Mathlete, who took KenPom's point distribution numbers and combine them with efficiency. Michigan's defense is first in the entire country at free throw points per possession against, and they're second in 3-point points per possession against. To score against this team, you're gonna have to work it inside. We all know that ain't easy. Now be careful out there, because this last one is a real pants dropper. After updating for the Ohio State game, Michigan's adjusted defensive efficiency of 83.8 would be the best in the history of KenPom. Baby, grab me a cigarette. Well, if that hasn't totally scared you off, I would like to briefly address a different subject entirely, which is taunting. I thought Michigan did a wonderful job of it against Ohio State last night, and I would love to see more. This is a team that may have put "do more, say less" on their shirts last year, but that was certainly not how the team actually conducted themselves between Mo Wagner's constant trash talking, Charles Matthews' willingness to get up and literally laugh in your face, Xavier Simpson being Xavier Simpson, and all the rest. And now this year's Michigan team has Jordan Poole in a even larger role, a guy who is not going to back off from letting you know how good he thinks he is and how not as good he thinks you are. They've still got Simpson and Matthews. And yeah, Jordan Poole, as he came to the bench after last night, may have taken the OHIO chant and moved it down towards a particular region that, maybe you were thinking about in the last segment. This bothered a lot of Ohio State fans, which I guess I understand. Why am I saying that? I don't understand it. It's BS. Let the man taunt. Michigan's winning by 16 in a game that was hotly contested for a little bit and then involved a lot of chippiness between two rivals. You know, we were, this was our Jordan Hall double birds, and I loved Jordan Hall's double birds. I was on the record at the time loving Jordan Hall's double birds. We have embraced that as the MGO in the MGO blog community. It is in Brian's game column for football every week. And yeah, if you don't want to get taunted, don't lose. In related news, read "Great Teams Taunt" by Spencer Hall of Every Day Should Be Saturday and SB Nation, which was published this week and is a delightful read, both for his take on the subject, which is largely what inspired this segment, and the many GIFs and videos that are contained therein, including Baker Mayfield planting Oklahoma's flag on Ohio State's field. Let's appreciate that, not complain about it. Big Ten has very much separated itself out at this point. There is a very clear top two, as you have probably guessed. It is Michigan State and Michigan. If you go by efficiency margin in conference, which is just your offensive efficiency, points per 100 possessions minus defensive efficiency, Michigan State is at 18.8. Michigan is at plus 16.3. No other team in the conference crests 10. So this is a very clear delineation. Not that that was particularly surprising, but for a while there, it looked like there may be a team or two that could pop into that top range. There were teams getting into the higher regions of KenPom, but Maryland has fallen off a little bit. Nebraska has fallen off a lot, and now even after Michigan State finally suffered their first conference loss to Purdue, which has drawn Michigan into a tie for first place in the conference, this is very much a two-team race, and very much a situation where either of these teams can be pretty darn confident going into any conference game right now. The next two teams by efficiency margin in the Big Ten are almost deadlocked. Wisconsin is at plus 9.8, and Purdue is at plus 9.6. Purdue had probably the biggest win of the week with that victory over Michigan State, albeit a Michigan State team that is currently missing Josh Langford for, you know, whatever that's worth, which, in fairness, I'm down on Langford as a player, but Michigan State, it's a big loss for them in large part because they just have very little backcourt depth, and he is at least an assertive offensive player. They do not have other assertive backcourt offensive players other than Cassius Winston, who's already shouldering a huge load, and Matt McQuaid, who has to shoulder a very huge defensive load. But still, Purdue with an impressive win, you know, especially since it wasn't a spectacular game for Carson Edwards. This was a solid all-around effort. Meanwhile, Wisconsin is on a four-game winning streak, their latest by 11 at Nebraska, and they have a pretty big contest coming up on Friday against Maryland. They have been winning ugly, ugly basketball games, normally barely getting over 1 point per possession, sometimes not even getting there, but they've been playing fantastic defense. As we saw when Wisconsin played Michigan, I think they've found something in Nate Roivers in terms of having him be their main pick and roll defender, while Ethan Happ gets to kind of roam a little bit. And Happ is playing at a near National Player of the Year level. It would be a National Player of the Year level, probably, but, you know, Zion Williamson exists. And Roivers has been excellent lately, which has helped take at least a tiny bit of the load off of Ethan Happ. It is never going to be a light load for him, but it seems like Wisconsin has found a solid combination there, a winning combination. And so those four teams, along with Maryland, who whooped up on a Northwestern team that looks absolutely abject right now after the Terps had dropped two straight, one at MSU, which is quite understandable, and the other in an odd neutral site game at Madison Square Garden against Illinois, less understandable, in which they coughed up 21 turnovers. But Maryland still holding on to a 5 seed in the bracket matrix. They're actually above Wisconsin right now, although with the way the season is progressing, I would expect that to change. But those five teams are the only teams in the conference that have a positive efficiency margin. This is a very unbalanced conference right now in terms of it is ranked as the best conference in the country by KenPom, but the teams at the top end are carrying a lot of that weight, especially the two Michigan teams. Then Iowa is the next team on the list in both efficiency margin and where they land in the bracket matrix. They're on the 6 seed line along with Wisconsin, but we'll see how long that lasts. They've dropped 2 straight at home against Michigan State. Again, pretty understandable. At Minnesota, a little bit less so, especially since it was a ridiculous shootout, and their Iowa's defense, which had at least slightly bounced back from just a horrific showing last year, is now back down to 126th on KenPom. They have easily surpassed Rutgers now for worst defense in the conference. They have the worst two-point defense in the conference. They are just horrific all around. It is somewhat difficult to comprehend because they certainly, by talent and size and experience, should not have the worst defense in the conference. But this has been an issue for Fran McCaffrey now for a while. And it's something, I mean, this is a season where if it continues to go in this direction, especially since Iowa's next game, they have to travel to the Chrysler Center on Friday. This is something where you'd wonder if Fran had a serious hot seat situation going, but Gary Barta gave him a secret extension right before he went out the door as athletic director, which makes things a lot more complicated for Iowa and probably makes them more hoping for a situation like what Michigan had with John Beilein recently, where the head coach acknowledges that he's got some shortcomings in a certain area and really uses his assistant coaches to help shore that up. But for this season, it's starting to look a little bit like last year for Iowa, and they may start slipping to the wrong side of the bubble. They're giving up 111.8 points for 100 possessions in Big Ten play. It's just brutal. Speaking of which, Nebraska has lost four straight, the last two at home by double digits. They were in the teens for a long time on KenPom, even getting up as high as 11th, but this was mostly for a series of good losses and strong performances in guarantee games. They didn't have as much on the quality win side of the spectrum, and now in conference play, things are really starting to fall apart for them. Their only good win away from home in conference was at Indiana, a team that is in an even worse free fall right now. Otherwise, things have just kind of stopped working for them. They do not really seem to have much of an offense. It bogs down. James Palmer is a really high usage guy who is not efficient right now, and they just do not have the shooters around him to really open things up for a team that needs guys who are able to get to the basket off the dribble. They've got some really quality defensive players, especially Isaiah Roby. They did also suffer a big loss when Isaac Copeland was lost for the season, I believe at the end of the Ohio State game. But they had already started dropping off before that. And they're another team where, you know, they're currently holding on to a bubble spot already on the bracket matrix as a 9 seed. A lot of those brackets have not included their recent skid, and that probably means they're going to be falling even further. Somewhat in that same vein right now is Ohio State, the team Michigan just beat, which has dropped 6 of the last 7. They are the most turnover-prone team in the conference. Michigan got to see that and experience that quite a bit. Last night, Ohio State had 19 turnovers. That's a solid 31% of their possessions. That was not wildly out of the norm for them. They're at 21.4% in conference play, and they're offensive efficiency has dropped below 100. This is a team that is relying very heavily on Caleb Wesson, who has a difficult time staying on the floor. Once again, this is a team that is already on the bubble and headed in the wrong direction. And in that vein, and then we get to Minnesota, a team that has at least figured out how to alternate wins and losses, which they have done all of conference season. They are currently at 5-4, but their efficiency margin is actually below all of the aforementioned teams. They are 9th in the conference at minus 4.2 points per 100 possessions. They have the second worst defense in the conference ahead of only Iowa, allowing 108.3 points per possession. And while they don't have injury issues like Nebraska does, and they're not in a free fall state like Iowa or Nebraska or Indiana, this is still a bit of a tenuous situation. They've got some really difficult games to close out the season. They still have to go to Purdue and Michigan State and Maryland, and their home games are not a whole lot easier. They have Wisconsin and Michigan and Purdue again. So there's not a lot of let up over the end of this year. I am not the world's biggest believer in Richard Pitino. So it's going to be wild, coming down to the end of the season. Oh, and then before I talk about the upshot, Indiana has been in the biggest free fall of anybody. They have now dropped down below Illinois, significantly in efficiency margin. They have lost 6 straight games. They play at Rutgers tonight. They are favored by 2 on KenPom. That is just 2 points against Rutgers. They have a minus 10.5 efficiency margin. in conference play right now. They're getting booed by their home crowd. This seems to be falling apart quickly, even more quickly than things are falling apart for the other Big Ten teams. It's early yet for a hot seat for Archie Miller, but this is about as rough a start as you could possibly imagine for his tenure there. And you've got to wonder if they're going to face some attrition this offseason, just because this season has been so ugly. And the main guys that it's running through, the other thing is that it's not necessarily going to be better next year. Juwan Morgan graduates and Romeo Langford will be in the NBA. Nobody else has been particularly good this year. So they're going to need young talent to really mature quickly, or Archie Miller's tenure may never really get off the ground. But they are down in the Northwestern, Penn State, Rutgers tier right now in efficiency margin and conference. That is not going to keep you in the NCAA tournament, and I can't imagine any Indiana fans expect that right now. They're in a turned down an NIT bid kind of state. The positive there, I guess, is that Illinois has pulled their way out of that bottom group a little bit. For a while there, they were below Rutgers. So those teams, I don't really consider them worth talking about right now. They're not going to be making much postseason noise. And if they beat anybody right now, it's going to be one of those losses that we look at come selection time and wonder if that's what put a team on the wrong side of the bubble. But this is a really interesting year for the committee and what they decide to do with the Big Ten, because you have to figure out, do you penalize the conference for the strength at the top and how much it's kind of impacted the kind of soft middle a little bit? At the same time, and you could maybe use that to put in some teams that will not put up gaudy conference records, but if you're just looking at how these teams are playing on an individual basis, the individual cases could be tough. So this was, I know early on we had been looking at the Big Ten as potentially getting somewhere between 8 to 10 bids. That number is probably coming down. But for Michigan fans, it's bad if from a conference pride perspective, but from a Michigan perspective, if you want this team to rack up as many wins as possible and put up a ridiculous record and secure a one seed, things are looking pretty good on that front right now, because there's really only four other teams in the conference that should hang with them right now. All right, got one more news segment for you. We're going to call this one On Topic, Off Topic, as a nod to both the message board and my habit of straying off topic. I'll be looking at stories both related to Michigan sports and not that I've enjoyed in stuff I've read recently, stuff I've listened to recently, stuff I've seen recently. Whatever stories happen to be most relevant that I think are worth talking about. Bomani Jones does something similar on his very excellent podcast, The Right Time, which highly recommend if you haven't checked that one out. But today I'm just going to focus on one kind of old story with a new that's updated slightly and a way that it ended up making its way onto my Twitter timeline. So some of you might have seen this over last weekend, but it's something that hit close to home for me and I wanted to touch on. So to start with, I need to provide some background on the PACE trial, which was a study conducted in the mid-2000s and published in 2011. It was done in the UK by a group of doctors. It was at the time the most expensive bit of research ever conducted into ME/CFS, myalgical encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome, the name I hate. A lot of people prefer ME, and there's also some controversy about the name, but that's a topic for another day. But anyway, the PACE trial was short for Pacing Graded Activity and Cognitive Behavior Therapy, a Randomized Evaluation. Somehow that all is shortened to PACE. And the results of the study claimed essentially that what could help ME patients, something called graded exercise therapy, which is what it sounds like. Essentially that their findings were basically that the disease was mostly, the disease was psychological in nature, and that simply what you needed to do to get out of it was exercise at a, you know, gradually starting from a very low level and gradually increasing your level of output until you were back to normal. As anybody with ME can tell you, I mean, at the time this raised a lot of red flags because, the main symptom of people with ME is post-exertional malaise. In other words, when you put out a bunch of energy, you end up crashing. And the crashes can be really rough. I've been in one recently. And, I mean, if you followed along with me, just following along with my story, you've probably seen at various times, me exhibit a higher level of activity. You know, there was the pool basketball picture I posted a couple summers ago when I thought I'd had a breakthrough, and, pictures of me shooting around at the hoop by my place when I, had recovered enough from surgery to be able to physically lift my hands above my head. And I was somebody who played, you know, every sport possible when I was growing up until high school when health stuff started coming into play. But even after that, you know, I was always somebody who was down to play pickup basketball or play, you know, on a flag football team in college. You know, I was always, if I have the energy, I'm always inclined to use it, but I'm extremely careful not to because of what I have. So the PACE trial suggested something that seemed counterintuitive at best for patients with ME. And as it turns out, when they released their methodology, it was deeply flawed, was debunked. It has been debunked a couple different times over at this point. Unfortunately, it is still the basis for guidelines to treat ME and CFS in the UK, in the United States. In the UK, it's the basis for NHS-provided care, you know, their National Health Service. In the United States, the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, stuff like WebMD as well, recommend graded exercise therapy, referencing PACE, and also recommending treating it like a psychological illness, again, citing PACE trial evidence. You know, there's been a large outcry from patients, and then also multiple scientific studies that have debunked the methodology of this study, and therefore its conclusions. The problem is that we are still very much working to undo. I say we. This is not really something I have taken on yet. The ME community has worked very hard, along with some doctors, who specialize in this area, to undo the damage of this study and the damage it continues to do as doctors, hospitals continue to use this faulty research as the basis for treatment for a little understood illness. It's caused a lot of damage to patients, a lot of which, you know, doctors didn't realize they were doing because they were following national guidelines. And when you dig deeper, it gets a little worse. One of the authors of the study, Peter White, had been consulting with insurance companies about how to manage claims for chronic fatigue syndrome. And when you combine that with a recommendation that it's patients who often require rather expensive treatments, you know, I've spent tens of thousands of dollars seeing specialists and paying for medication and paying for surgery in one case. But exercise is quite cheap. So if you're a doctor working with an insurance company and you want to hand them a study that allows them to greatly limit the amount of money that they give to ME and CFS patients, you know, based on this study, the PACE study could not have been more perfectly handed to them. And this came up this week because there was a debate in British Parliament that was brought on thanks to the work of the charity group ME Action, where we at least had a forum for people to talk about this stuff, talk about the extreme lack of funding, talk about how research needs to be focused on finding biomedical markers for the illness, what causes it, how to treat it. You know, we are way, way, way behind on the science here. And part of it is because this study has gotten in the way. It's been used as the standard and been defended to the hilt by its authors, even though it has been proven faulty. If you would like more of the details of that, there's a great article in Stat News, statnews.com. An article by Julie Rehmeyer, Rehmeyer, that was published in 2016, called Bad Science Misled Millions with Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, Here's How We Fought Back. So anyway, Peter White is one of the authors of this study. He shortly after the raw data behind the study was released, he coincidentally retired from clinical practice, but he still has friends, as was evidenced this week when, seemingly out of nowhere, a man named Danny Blanchflower started arguing on Twitter with a lot of ME and chronic fatigue syndrome patients, and questioning the legitimacy of the push to do away with the PACE trial as the basis for treatment, focus in the interim on things that we know work, which at this point is essentially rest, and put funding into something more legitimate. Blanchflower's very well-articulated arguments were essentially that ME patients are a bunch of whiners, and that nobody had showed him any sort of real evidence that the PACE study had been debunked, and that people who hadn't managed to make themselves healthy through graduated exercise had probably just gone too fast. And to demonstrate, he talked about how he had to take things slow at physical therapy after he broke his ankle. And several people were sending him, in very recent tones, the science behind debunking the PACE trial. And this guy, who has 60-something thousand followers on Twitter, was quote-tweeting them and blocking them so that he could make his point, but other people couldn't see on his timeline even what arguments were being made against him. And someone, in response to one of these statements mentioned that you know, they'd prefer to go with the science as opposed to Mr. Blanchflower. And he corrected him and said it's actually Dr. Blanchflower, and I have several honorary degrees. I'm doing this off of screenshots and off of my memory, by the way, because he has also blocked me. Because when he said that, I decided to click on the link in his bio to his professor page, his personal website, which shows that he is, in fact, a doctor of economics at Dartmouth, which has absolutely nothing to do with knowledge of chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalomyelitis, or anything close to that. But what a little bit of digging did reveal is that he's friends with Peter White, again, the lead investigator of the PACE trial, and now a disgraced doctor. And this is something that, to the ME community, is obvious, is an easy connection to make. As soon as you see it, you go, oh, this guy is just going to bat for his friend. This is some rather disgusting cronyism. But to the 60,000 followers of his, if there really are that many, his engagement kind of seems to indicate that he may have bought some of those. But he did have, you know, I checked our mutuals, and there were some legitimate journalists following him. And he is a professor of econ at Dartmouth. So he does have a certain platform. And I can only imagine, based on the average population and what I've run into in my experience with this illness and that of many other people, I highly, highly doubt that the vast majority of the people following him have any idea what the PACE trial is, or even a baseline familiarity with ME/CFS, or any of the issues surrounding it, or really the basics of the illness itself. So normally this is something that I'd just try to ignore, but when someone is willfully spreading misinformation because of a buddy-buddy relationship with somebody who already has shown to have some sketchy relationships himself and has done a lot of damage to a marginalized community, I think it's time to speak out. So if you are so inclined, his, you know, I'm no longer able to tweet at him, but his at is D_Blanchflower. That is B-L-A-N-C-H-F-L-O-W-E-R. There you can also find his personal webpage, which lists his office, which may also list his phone and fax number. Do with that what you will. I've already left a message for his department informing them that the conduct that he displayed online was, I think, quite unbecoming for a Dartmouth professor, especially somebody who was very much stepping outside his field of expertise. And yeah, you can block us online, but you can't block us off. And even if all that this results in is a little bit of a stir on Twitter and maybe somebody in his department telling him to cool it, you know, I'm not trying to get anybody fired here, but this is something where when people get this far out of line about something that's done this much damage to this many people, at least bringing it to his colleagues' awareness, and since he is doing it in the, you know, he's speaking on Twitter in their name, as a Dartmouth econ professor, he does not shy away from representing himself that way. Somebody with that kind of platform using it for what he did, even if it just gets him a stern topic talking to, would be a step in the right direction. We are talking about baby steps with this community when it comes to public recognition of the illness and the discourse around it. So yeah, if you want to leave a message with the Dartmouth Economics Department letting them know how you feel about the way their professor is behaving, after your view of his Twitter timeline, if you scroll back a few days, you very much might be inclined to do that. And if you do, I am deeply grateful for it, because usually ME patients are left to advocate for themselves, and if it's not them, it's their caretakers. So if we can get people from outside the direct community to do a little bit of that, that's another huge step in the right direction. Thank you very much for listening to the ACE Pod. I hope you'll return. I understand if you don't. Play me out, Barry. You touch a gun, but don't you know you can't hide? No, no, baby. When you give it up, it's only enough to get me by.